Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does Alzheimer's disease ravage the brain, and how much hope do scientists have that we might someday learn to stop its progress or prevent it altogether? As the population of elderly Americans continues to grow, experts predict that 20 years from now, we will have 50% more Alzheimer's cases than the 5.1 million battling the disease today in this country. My guest this afternoon is hoping to change that future by working on a vaccine designed to fight the buildup of a protein found in excess in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. And he's encouraging health researchers to shift the focus from curing brains damaged by Alzheimer's to finding ways to ward off the worst effects of the disease before they set in. Dr. Roger Rosenberg is director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center and Abe Morris and William Zale Distinguished Chair in Neurology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So before we talk about progress in perhaps eventually treating the disease, talk a little bit about what we've learned about the effects of Alzheimer's on the brain. How do the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease differ from those of healthy patients?
The pathology of Alzheimer's disease is one of progressive loss of nerve cells, we call neurons, and their connections, synaptic connections, so that the circuitry for information storage and retrieval becomes simpler and cannot be processed to the same degree of accuracy, speed, and complexity. And so the circuits fail, and they result in impaired thinking. So it's an involution. It's a deterioration. It's a neurodegenerative progressive process of loss of neurons, nerve cells, and their connections associated with the storage of toxic proteins in the brain.
And one of those toxic proteins is this substance called amyloid beta. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It accumulates very early in the disease process. We believe it occurs as early as 15 years before the mean age of onset in families for symptoms. It's a very early toxic accumulation. It does begin to cause loss of connections, and it may go on for 15 years before the patient begins to develop any serious memory loss. And so that's a key point, that we need to identify individuals early and develop therapy to address it before the brain develops a pathology to the point it cannot recover. So time is of the essence.
So at what point can you, I guess you can do a spinal tap to find these proteins, is that right?
That's correct. You can do a spinal tap, you can remove the brain water, and you can analyze it specifically for the level of the amyloid beta 2 protein that you referred to. And if it begins to decrease in the brain water, that means it's accumulating within the brain itself. Mm-hmm. The brain is functioning as a sink, and the toxic amyloid protein accumulates between nerve cells, causes loss of connections, and eventually nerve cells. So, yes, we can identify that very early, 15 years in many families before symptoms begin. Now the hope is to develop anti-amyloid therapy that can address it.
And this is where the vaccine that you've been working on comes in. How does that work?
The vaccine works. It is a vaccine which is encoded for DNA, the unit of inheritance. And the DNA that we use in the vaccine codes for amyloid. Mm-hmm. And so by injecting the DNA for amyloid into the skin, and in this case, experimental Alzheimer model mice, the immune system of the mouse develops an antibody against the amyloid, which the skin itself makes, driven and directed by the DNA. The antibody against the amyloid generated in the skin transits into brain and binds to the amyloid in brain, which then evokes an immune response inside the brain, and cells begin to scavenge, begin to digest and remove the amyloid in the brain, and we're able to show a 50% reduction in the transgenic mouse model for Alzheimer's disease after several months of DNA vaccination. So we've published a number of papers on this, and the hope now is to begin to develop our plans to test it in individuals who are asymptomatic but who are storing amyloid, as we just discussed, either by doing a spinal tap and analyzing the brain water, or by doing what we call a PET scan and show non-invasively that the amyloid is accumulating and the patient is unaware of it, is asymptomatic. That would be the time that you would want to generate an antibody against this amyloid and develop the mechanisms within the brain to remove it. That's our strategy.
So you think ultimately, let's assume that everything goes exactly as we're both hoping and as you've been dedicated years of your career to working on, would, if this were given routinely to patients, would this happen in midlife? Would it happen in early old age? Would it happen in childhood? What's the best time for a vaccine like this?
The age range for Alzheimer's disease is fairly broad. It usually, as you know, occurs after 60 years of age, 65, 70, and the prevalence doubles every 5 years. Mm-hmm. So clearly, we would pinpoint around 70 years of age, perhaps earlier, and identify a whole group of individuals between 60 and 70 years of age who show the abnormality of a low amyloid in their brain water by doing a spinal tap. And those would be the individuals we would want to treat. There are other forms of Alzheimer's disease that occur much earlier, and in a sense, they're more aggressive. And in these individuals, a spinal tap, by virtue of their family history showing that, we would do a spinal tap even in the late 30s or early 40s. But they are the exception. We call them the outliers. And some individuals develop symptoms in their 80s or 90s. Mm-hmm. But I would sort of pick between 65 and 70 as the group to target. So you go in for your annual physical, and you get your blood work drawn. And every once in a while, you probably should have colonoscopy done. But if you have a family history of Alzheimer's disease, or you're just concerned, you're 60 years of age, and now we theoretically have therapy, anti-amyloid therapy for Alzheimer's disease, well, doctor, I want to have a spinal tap. I want to see if my brain water amyloid is low so that I can prevent Alzheimer's disease from occurring, no different than I want my cholesterol checked. And if it's elevated before I have coronary artery disease or any symptoms of coronary artery disease, I want to be started on a statin to reduce my cholesterol. I don't want to be treated for heart attacks. I want to be treated for the risk factor that causes it. Or to an oncologist, you want to find the tumor early before it spreads. So time is of the essence, particularly in the brain where the cells are not dividing. Nerve cells don't divide. And so a nerve cell gone is pretty well gone in terms of the complexity of the circuit that it was functioning within. So we want to identify Alzheimer at-risk persons very early. And a population in analysis of examining individuals by doing a lumbar puncture is the approach that seems to us right now to be the most effective way, epidemiologically or studying large populations, to reduce the prevalence of the disease.
Just to be clear, for patients who find out today, we're talking about a lot of very optimistic things, but they're in the future. Today, if you find out that maybe in 15 years you'd be at risk of developing the early signs of dementia, we don't have a proven therapy right now.
We do not have a proven therapy right now. Mm-hmm. And the feeling is that anti-amyloid therapy, which is leading the way in terms of potential molecular targets that we have on the table to consider, has to be addressed before patients have symptoms of mm-hmm. dementia. It becomes clear that by the time a patient presents with early, middle-stage Alzheimer's disease, the brain is rather far advanced in the storage of these toxic proteins and is far advanced in loss of the neurons, nerve cells, and loss of connectivity. One can see that very straightforward by doing an MRI, get a picture, an image of the brain when the patient comes in to see you. And you can see that there is a significant degree of atrophy or shrinkage of the brain at the time the patient is presenting with symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, dementia, impairment in thinking, judgment, reasoning, abstraction, and so forth. At that time, the brain is far advanced in pathology and is very resistant mm-hmm. to anti-amyloid therapy. And there's evidence, actually, that even if you gave anti-amyloid therapy at the time a patient had mid-stage or early Alzheimer's disease and you reduce it significantly in their papers to that effect, the other more downstream or later pathologies are autonomous and they mm-hmm. continue. So it's a very narrow window that we're looking at here. And the window seems to be asymptomatic, early individuals who have minimal changes in their brain, minimal meaning only some storage of amyloid that we can identify either by analysis of brain water or a PET scan. Those are the persons we want to find.
Does almost everybody, if they reach a certain age, have at least some buildup of amyloid in the brain?
There's a high percent. Mm-hmm. And there are individuals who actually have an accumulation of amyloid which approaches that or maybe even exceeds the average. These are outliers again, and yet they don't have symptoms. It's a very complex business that amyloid deposition is necessary for the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease to occur, but it may not be sufficient. You may have to have another pathology, which is the accumulation of what we call the tau protein or tangles mm-hmm. with inside nerve cells. That may be necessary. The two together may be required to go on and produce loss of nerve cells. So, yes, I think that's an important point. So that if we talk about the genetics of Alzheimer's disease, and we think perhaps hundreds, maybe thousands of small variations in genes add up and produce a altered defective metabolic pathway that leads to the pathology of Alzheimer's disease, some individuals may also be have the benefit of inheriting variations, protective variations, that despite the amyloid accumulation, despite the secondary accumulation of the tangles, are resistant mm-hmm. to the pathology of Alzheimer's disease. So there's sort of a balance here. There are variations in genes we think that cause the disease. That's the main issue. And aging is the main issue. And in some individuals, and perhaps all of us to some degree, there are protective variations that will determine the age of onset, the rate of progression, the severity of the disease, and other comorbidities like associated Parkinson's disease, associated psychiatric features, or even vascular disease. So it's a complex mix of variations in genes here that are responsible for the pathology and symptoms of the disease and other modifying genes that may determine the complexity of the age or even the presence of whether the disease will be fully expressed or minimally expressed.
In terms of genetic vulnerability, there is one gene. Is it APOE4?
APOE4. Mm-hmm. Approximately 50% of the Alzheimer population carries the APOE4. One copy from mother, one copy from father sometimes, so they're homozygous, but just one copy, and it does definitely increase your risk. The normal population who does not have Alzheimer's is about 15%. So the risk goes up about 3.5 to 4-fold if you have an APOE. And the risk seems to be that the APOE form, which is very important for cholesterol transport, that seems to be one of the reasons why it has been selected for in evolution for cholesterol transport through the brain. APOE 3 and 4 bind to the A beta 42 amyloid that you referred to. Mm-hmm. And the E4 binds to it tighter than does the more common E3. So if you have the genetic inheritance of E4, you're going to store amyloid sooner and faster and more abundantly than the person who is E3. So you'll build up the plaque more rapidly, and you'll build up what we call the soluble form, which may be even the more toxic form of amyloid earlier. So yes, E4 is the major genetic risk factor. And now we've identified about 37 additional gene risk factors because of variations in those genes. We know what the gene products are of those genes. Now the challenge is, how do we fit this pattern together into a metabolic pathway? How do we use these clues of variations in these 38 genes, which is just the beginning of this complex cascade of other variations, into sets of metabolic pathways that ends up with the common pathology of Alzheimer's disease? You could even say, Chris, that there is no such thing as Alzheimer's disease. At the genetic level, it's diseases. There are multiple variations of polymorphisms, variations in hundreds, probably thousands of genes that are out there, that these variations add up to produce a common pathology, and that the variations themselves produce a variation in the kind of disease a person will have. Mm-hmm. As I said, age of onset, rate of progression, and other comorbidities, psychiatric features, and so forth. I think with increased funding, which is desperately needed, I think you can surmise from the information I've provided you that we've made a lot of progress, a lot of talented people.
We'll talk more about that after a quick break. My guest is Dr. Roger Rosenberg, director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at UT Southwestern. We will take your calls as well. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Roger Rosenberg. He's director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center and distinguished chair in neurology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. We are talking this hour about Alzheimer's disease research. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Dr. Rosenberg, I know that you are passionate about making headway in dealing with this disease and also about the importance of spending money to do it. How does Alzheimer's funding right now, there's been more allocated under the Obama administration, but how does that compare with cancer funding?
The National Cancer Institute funds cancer research at the rate of about $6 billion with a B dollars per year. The NIH, with the increase of $50 million from the Obama administration very recently, will approach about $500 million. So we're 10% or less. The increase to NCI for cancer per year is more than the total funding of the NIH for Alzheimer's disease research. And we need more funding. I can tell you from going to national neuroscience meetings, there are wonderful scientists doing very creative, very exciting research. We need more funding to do that. We can't depend on the pharmaceutical industry. We can't just throw total dollars that industry spends, $1 billion a year, and come up with ideas, because industry has not. But it's the individual investigator, individuals like me and in universities who have some ideas, who want to test them, who have looked at the metabolic pathways and molecular targets and have creative insights, writing NIH grants that should be funded. I think the individual investigator is going to lead the way here with creative new ideas. And we hope that the NIH and the United States Congress will look at it that way.
Well, given the epidemic rise in the expected incidence of cases over the next 20 years, a 50% increase in cases, and part of that has to do with the growing elder population, but is there an element of ageism here? Why wouldn't we put more money into this thing that is, if I understand correctly, 100% lethal?
Right. It's not clear why we are lagging in this regard. Surely cancer is a very emotional subject, and it doesn't just affect the aged. It affects the population across from infancy right on through older individuals. And so maybe the Alzheimer population, the aging population, the older population, the numbers aren't as dominant, and maybe we're not as articulate in making our case. Mm-hmm. And my hope and my colleagues' hope is through public education of the program of the kind that you have here and what we're trying to discuss will help to let the public at large know that there are excellent research projects and excellent ideas that must be tested. We do have the molecular targets, and we do have some insights. Amyloid is an insight, and there is one drug which was just published in Science magazine, bexotolene, which increases the ApoE level in the brain and decreases the amount of amyloid rather quickly, and that the behavior of the experimental mouse model of these mice improves dramatically over a short period of time.
And that's a skin cancer drug, is that right?
That's a skin cancer drug for T-cell lymphoma. So here's an individual at Case Western Reserve University who found this, working with a small number of people in a lab. That's the best example I can give. Mm-hmm. Others have looked at exercise as a way of increasing connectivity, increasing nerve cells in the brain. And we at UT Southwestern in our Alzheimer's Center, we are looking at exercise specifically as a means of trying to slow down or prevent Alzheimer's rate of progression. And so that's research we're doing, and we're looking for individuals to help us, both controls and Alzheimer individuals in that regard. So, yes, I think that with increased funding to the individual investigator, to the Alzheimer's centers, to look at Centers for Excellence doing basic biological research on the disorder, to look at the genetics and the genomics of this disorder, the whole spectrum of all 25,000 genes that we have in our genome, we will find this hidden inheritance. We've looked at what we call genome-wide association studies. We found the variations in several dozen genes mm-hmm. now. But we haven't found the full inheritance. We have to do deep sequencing of the full genome. We have to find all of the coding and non-coding genes that make proteins and genes that don't make proteins, genes that make intermediate metabolites and genes that just make what we call RNA. What does it mean? There's a clue there. And I think if we do come up with the additional hundreds of millions of dollars to do deep sequencing, to analyze the full DNA of the genome of many thousands of individuals with different forms of Alzheimer's disease and normal controls, we will find the specific genetic differences which will lead us to the metabolic pathways, plural, that lead to the common pathology of the disease, which will allow therapeutics to address the disease earlier. I think it will happen, but we need to develop a strategy and an initiative now to accomplish it.
So when we do a show like this, people are very interested in what you and your colleagues are doing in the lab and in clinical settings, and they also want to know what they can do for themselves. And you mentioned exercise may be a factor in preventing the onset of the disease. What about things like diet and other lifestyle choices?
I'm glad you asked. The NIH just published a study on at-risk protective factors. And they were very analytical, very comprehensive, and it was an excellent panel. And basically, their conclusion was there really isn't anything of substance scientifically proven that will reduce the risk for Alzheimer's disease. Diet, well, you don't want to have a high-fat or red meat diet, not necessarily to reduce the rate or prevent Alzheimer's, but maybe vascular disease, hardening of the arteries, which just is an additional burden on the brain. So when we talk about the benefits of diet, the Mediterranean diet, fruits and vegetables, I don't want to leave the impression that we are preventing Alzheimer's disease, but we might be preventing other reasons for impairment in thinking, like strokes or vascular disease, which is superimposed. So we have to be careful. We're talking about preventive of perhaps cognitive loss or impairment in thinking, but not addressing directly the biology of the disease, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, over-the-counter medications that reduce inflammation. There are papers pro and con. Food stores that sell specific items that are supposed to help benefit your mental health. All of these were looked at very carefully by this NIH panel, and the conclusion, the judgment is they are not of significant benefit. The one thing that may be of significant benefit is aerobic exercise. The more aerobic exercise a person puts in seems to reduce perhaps as much by a third the rate of the biology of Alzheimer's disease, and it probably also reduces the rate of vascular disease in the brain too. And the two do add up in a rather arithmetical way.
Turns out there's pretty much nothing that exercise isn't good for.
I agree. What's good for the heart seems to be good for the brain.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We've got lots of folks on the line. Let's start with Lee in Fort Worth. Hi, Lee.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to ask Dr. Rosenberg, does he have any trepidation about setting up an inflammatory cascade in the brain? Because once you have antibody binding to a target protein, you have complement fixation, you have chemotaxis, you have all kinds of immune cells coming in. You have glial cell activation in the brain. Have you sectioned these mouse brains to look for collateral damage?
Yes, that's a good point. You have to be very careful and define what is the immune response that you're producing. There are examples. There are papers, specifically a vaccination program using amyloid protein, the peptide A-beta 42, as you probably know, which was published in 1999 in the very prestigious journal Nature. And it had a very dramatic response in Alzheimer mice. It dramatically reduced the level of amyloid, and it was then set up as a clinical trial. And some 300 individuals received two doses of the amyloid protein vaccine. And after about a year or so, 6% or 18 developed exactly what you said, which was an autoimmune, inflammatory, progressive deterioration in brain with infarcts and what we call edema, swelling of the brain, and so forth. And the FDA stepped in and shut it down. So in developing the DNA vaccine, the number one principle behind this strategy, as you have very precisely stated, is to develop an immune response which is non-inflammatory. The inflammatory response, not to get into technical details about the peptide trial, which was shut down, produced exactly what you said, an inflammatory immune response. The DNA immune response is totally different. It was designed this way with the thought in mind that if we use DNA and inject it into the skin, we would get a non-inflammatory immune response. And our papers published to this point, six of them indicate, indeed, it is very different than the inflammatory protein immune response with amyloid from the DNA amyloid coding immune response. So that's been the primary trajectory and principle and goal behind all of the DNA vaccine research, is to show convincingly that it's safe, that it will not be toxic and will not lead to inflammation. And yes, we have looked at the brains of these mice and we do not see it. And we have looked at what we call the toxic proteins, the so-called cytokines that are or are not inflammatory. And with DNA vaccination, we only see the non-inflammatory type. And that's the way we're going to proceed in the future with our additional studies. We're looking in a very detailed way now at great depth. Exactly what is the molecular immune response, and so far I can say that it is non-inflammatory.
So for research purposes, there are a lot of important similarities between, say, a mouse brain and a human brain, but clearly a human brain is more complex and has a lot more going on. Can you describe in a simple way the process by which you take something that has worked successfully in a rodent population and prepare a study that will use human volunteers?
It's very tightly prescribed by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. We have to convincingly show to them, and have not yet done so in three species and work we hope to start very soon, that the vaccination with DNA for amyloid does not show inflammation by either cellular response or by cytokines that are toxic to the brain in mice, in rabbits, and in monkeys. If that all passes, then we set up a phase one toxicity clinical trial, not to show any benefit, but to show it does no harm. Mm-hmm. And these would be individuals, as I've mentioned, who are about 70 years of age, who show no signs of Alzheimer's disease, but who, when we do a spinal tap, have abnormal low levels of amyloid in their brain water, and in when we do a PET scan, show that indeed they are accumulating it. So they are asymptomatic. We can do some neuropsychological tests and show that, yes, they have some deficits, but they're minor deficits. They are showing some changes which we will follow. So then when we do the DNA vaccine, then we have to go through a very, very thorough analysis to show that we're not harming individuals, that their neuropsychological test scores are not deteriorating, they're staying the same or improving, MRIs to show that there is no damage done to the brain by imaging, doing brain water analyses to show there's no inflammation with cells, and doing multiple blood work tests and immunologic blood work tests to show that there is no damage being done to any organs. It's a very tightly prescribed, very comprehensive analysis. And all of the data then are sent to the FDA for their determination to whether one can go on to a phase two, which then must show some benefit in terms of reduction or slowing of the amyloid being accumulated. And in phase three, to show clinically that they're not developing symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. So it's a very tightly and rigorously prescribed program to test any new drug.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Pete in Arlington. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
Your guest's topic today is hits close to home for me. I'm 71 years old, and I'm the very age at which my father was when he first started exhibiting Alzheimer's mm-hmm. symptoms, and he died at about age 78 in mid-stage Alzheimer's. So, of course, I worry a lot about this. I have a two-part question. The first, and a bit of brief information, I'll be brief. I have exercised aerobically for over 40 years, started right when I was about 30. And I've kept it up over the years. Consequently, from a cardiovascular standpoint, I'm quite healthy, although my electrical system in my heart's a little offbeat, so I have a pacemaker, but in terms of the plumbing, I'm in great shape.
Mm-hmm.
My first question is this. Is there any evidence that suggests a lifetime, which is about almost an adult lifetime of exercise, is a better preventive strategy than if you adopt exercise much later in life? That's the first question. And then the second question is, would someone like me be eligible to participate in your pilot program over at UT Southwestern?
Thanks for your call, Pete.
Sure. I think the earlier and the more aerobic exercise you do, you will reduce and have reduced, your good testimony to it from what you have said, of reducing the degree of cardiovascular, cardiopulmonary, atherosclerotic hardening of the artery disease. So I think you've done the right thing, and that's what I would encourage people to do as the only rational approach at this point before we have any drug therapy to reduce your risk for Alzheimer's, aerobic exercise. So keep going. When the time comes, if we get approval and get a license from the FDA to go ahead with a phase one toxicity clinical trial, we would be grateful for your interest and participation. We would have to do as we would for any individual entering a phase one study like this for any anti-amyloid therapy, is to be sure you don't have Alzheimer's disease, you don't have any significant serious memory impairment, no significant vascular disease in your brain, and you don't, and do a spinal tap, a lumbar puncture, to show that there are some changes, which would be the biomarker to show that with anti-amyloid therapy, not only are we doing no harm, but that we might be preventing the disease from progressing.
Pete mentioned that his father developed Alzheimer's at the same age that he is now. And I'm curious about, can we say for sure, is it a 2-to-1 risk or 3-to-1 risk if you have a close family member who has developed Alzheimer's?
It's about a 3-to-4-fold risk with a close family member like a parent or a sibling. If you have both parents that are affected, it goes up to 7-to-10-fold. So it's rather significant, and it's the best evidence we have that this is indeed a genetic disorder. So, yes, you have an increased risk because of a parent being affected, perhaps as much as a 3-fold risk. So you are doing the right thing by participating in a program of aerobic exercise. And when any anti-amyloid or therapy for Alzheimer's disease becomes available, because you're at risk, you want to be evaluated for it as soon as possible so that the pathology in your brain is at a lowest level to achieve protection.
My guest is Dr. Roger Rosenberg. He's director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at UT Southwestern. If you'd like to participate in this conversation about Alzheimer's disease research, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the latest Alzheimer's disease research with Dr. Roger Rosenberg, director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at UT Southwestern Medical Center. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Is it true that women are more likely to develop Alzheimer's than men?
It seems to be the case, yes. Perhaps women live longer, and age is the main issue behind it, but that's true.
So that appears, as far as anyone can tell, it's lifespan that has to do that accounts for that.
In part, I think that's the case, yes.
Mm-hmm. And is Alzheimer's that sets in at very early ages? You mentioned that Alzheimer's may be a series of diseases. Is that thought to be a vastly different disease than something people might develop in their 70s?
Well, I think Alzheimer's disease genetically has multiple different explanations as to why it produces a pathology, and we're starting to develop an understanding specifically of what the changes are at the gene level. So, but it is interesting, as you have emphasized, that aging seems to be the risk, and perhaps that's why women have a higher prevalence for the disorder. So there are genes that clearly cause aging, and different organs age at different rates. And so one could look upon Alzheimer's disease occurring as a neurological disease because the brain is aging faster than the chronological years. And so the genes that are responsible for aging become permissive. They produce specific changes that allow the opportunistic pathology of Alzheimer's disease to take root. One interesting insight is an experiment done a number of years ago by taking amyloid, the toxic protein we've been talking about, and the investigators at Harvard injected it into the brain of a young rhesus monkey. It had no effect. Took the same amount of the protein, same region of the brain in an aged rhesus monkey, and it produced the pathology, the toxic changes of Alzheimer's disease. So there's something very specific, very vulnerable, very sensitive about the aging process. We do understand some of the molecular biology, some of the genetics of aging. A number of genes have been identified. Sirtuins are genes that seem to be associated with aging throughout the evolutionary scale. And so, yes, there seems definitely to be a matrix, a foundation upon which the amyloid and the tangles and the other oxidative stress proteins and other changes in Alzheimer's disease are allowed to begin that don't occur in the young brain. So, yes, there is this interdigitation between aging and Alzheimer's disease. We have a sort of a distant glimpse of this interaction, but it's becoming into focus in the last several years.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Sue in Dallas. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Dr. Rosenberg and Chris. Thank you for the good work you do. My question is, how do people die from Alzheimer's? I've never quite connected the dots on that one.
Well, what happens is associated disorders happen. One thing that seems to happen is that appetite and eating decreases and weight loss occurs. And so an individual is not as robust in terms of fighting infection, perhaps because they're not taking in an adequate amount of vitamins and proteins and a balanced diet. And so infection on a nutritional basis is part of it. But there are motor features that also can happen, difficulty with swallowing. And as a result of that, pneumonias can happen. Individuals have difficulty ambulating, and so you get urinary tract infections because voiding is delayed, and sometimes bed sores. So these are these secondary changes that occur, that happen, and sometimes associated problems like Parkinson's disease occurs, and that just aggravates the motor and swallowing difficulties. And in the aged population, you have strokes that can occur, or heart failure, and so breathing and normal lung function becomes impaired. So there's a whole cascade of other events that lead to the final loss of the individual.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Joe in Addison. Hi, Joe. Hi, Joe. Are you with us? Turn off your radio, please. Okay. We will take a call instead from Jackie in Dallas. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Yes, I have a situation. Everything that the doctor just talked about actually has to do with my situation. I am at present losing a brother in a nursing home that was diagnosed with dementia at the age of 60.
Hmm.
And my mother also died at 72 with dementia, and her father died with dementia. He didn't develop it until the age of 95. Now, I'm 60, I'm going to be 61, and I've devoted my life, my adult life, to health and wellness. And I do the aerobic exercise and everything. But my question is, number one, if possible, when this research is available, if I can be a participant in that. And then also, what about all these omega-3 oils and omega-6s and as far as the brain?
Well, they have been looked at, I think, very carefully, and you do find papers on both sides of the aisle saying that they may prevent or slow down Alzheimer's disease. But a very careful analysis of all of them leads one to say that there is really no convincing evidence that omega fatty acids will prevent or slow the rate of Alzheimer's disease.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Catherine in Dallas. Hey, Catherine.
Hello. I'm curious, what is the difference, if any, between Alzheimer's and dementia?
The difference between Alzheimer's and dementia.
Well, dementia is the generic term, the catch-all term. It refers to the symptom of one's inability to think. One has cognitive loss to the point that one cannot function independently. The leading cause of dementia in the United States is Alzheimer's disease. So we're putting a specific label, a specific disease, on the general category of impairment of thinking.
It was only identified or named a little over a century ago, but clearly humans have struggled with this for a long time. Is it, in fact, getting worse because we are fortunate enough to be living long lives in the modern world?
Absolutely. The aging of our population clearly has increased the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. And as you have mentioned, at the present time, it's approaching 6 million Americans with Alzheimer's disease. And if we don't develop effective therapy in 20 years, that goes to 8 million as the population ages. And our population is aging. We are slowly aging as a population compared to other countries. In today's New York Times, there's an article on the op-ed page by David Brooks pointing out that the world at large is aging. And although the United States rate of aging is increasing, it's less than India or China or Japan, where there is a very significant increase in the rate accumulation of an aged population. And so they not only will have increased Alzheimer's disease, but their epidemic is going to be far more serious than the epidemic we're facing here in the United States. This is a worldwide issue. And so, yes, Chris, absolutely, we have to deal with this aggressively now because an avalanche, a tsunami of dementia is coming.
Another field of study has looked at whether there might be an environmental trigger that could be identified. And for a while, people were talking about aluminum. My understanding is that that's been disproven?
Disproven, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so people should have no fear about they're not preventing anything by not using aluminum cookware or things
Correct.
Like that. Okay.
Right.
We have an email here from Ray in Dallas who wants to know if puzzles, board games, interactive associations help prevent Alzheimer's.
We have to talk about the individual who is aging, 60s, 70s, 80s, who has some minor impairment in memory, does not qualify for a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, may have some memory impairment. I would say mental exercise, crossword puzzles, reading books, analyzing mathematical formulae, staying active intellectually and mentally clearly improves one's alertness, one's ability to function, to learn new things, and to feel creative. There's no evidence that that those events prevent Alzheimer's disease from occurring. I think they clearly are helpful in terms of maintaining the individual's maximum potential for cognitive functioning. But if the genes are there, and if the environmental issues that might be superimposed, like vascular disease, are there, and if Alzheimer's disease occurs, mental exercise doesn't stop the presence, the occurrence, the progression of Alzheimer's disease. It may delay. It may delay the onset of the disorder. I'll give you that. It does perhaps delay somewhat and does enhance one's potential before Alzheimer's disease occurs. But once the pathology is in place and the disease is progressing, mental exercise, in my respectful opinion, will not slow it down.
Mm-hmm. What do you recommend to newly diagnosed patients who may not know how long they have between the early stages and the point at which they cannot care for themselves? Is it just a time to sort of get one's affairs in order and make arrangements?
Well, I think one should be as hopeful and positive as possible. Get an assessment. Mm-hmm. Be sure that this is Alzheimer's disease and get an idea of how significant it is at this point. And what does the history indicate the rate of progression has been? And what might be some associated neurological features? What does the MRI look like? How much shrinkage of the brain is there at this point? These are very important indicators, soft indicators, but indicators that you can make some kind of qualitative statement as to rate of progression. And people do want to know, yes, in terms of making decisions. Do I start a business? Do I embark upon this major change in my life or not? And so I think it has practical value. And even individuals want to participate in research, as we have heard from some of the listeners. If they know that they have early disease, that they want it to have it identified and determined so that they can participate in an Alzheimer's study. But I think the important thing is find out if you have memory impairment, is it Alzheimer's disease? If you have thinking impairment, is it Alzheimer's disease or is it something else? Sometimes it can be an underactivity of the thyroid gland. Sometimes it could simulate as depression. Sometimes it could be other organs that might be failing, like a kidney failure might simulate early aspects of Alzheimer's disease, or vascular disease with small little strokes that need to be treated in terms of medication to lower blood pressure. So I really think a very thorough and a very careful analysis, find out what it is and go back at least for the first year, maybe once or twice to see what the rate might be and ask someone experienced, is this Alzheimer's disease? And based on my total profile of health in terms of my blood work and in terms of the neuropsychological test scores of what areas of impairment I have, but particularly my brain image, my MRI, does this look serious or doesn't it? And we can make these kinds of determinations.
As I understand it, there are a small handful of drugs that are occasionally prescribed to deal with the symptoms, if not the underlying disease. Are they very effective in your experience?
They're effective for perhaps a year or two. Mm-hmm. There are three FDA-proven drugs in this regard. They, as you say, they are drugs that reduce the symptoms of the disorder, increase focus, increase recent memory a bit. They don't touch the biology of the disorder. And that's why eventually the biology continues and these three medications become less and less effective. There's a paper that recently was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that suggested in some individuals who have more advanced Alzheimer's disease, they may last a little longer, yes. But I agree with you that on the balance, on the average, it's about a year or two.
Is this something you worry about for yourself at all?
Sure. It's important if you have a family history. I don't have that family history, and I do try to participate in aerobic exercise. But yes, there's no guarantee. And you have to do everything you can and be aware. So yes, I think we are all conscious and aware and need to be in order to deal with it as soon as we possibly can.
Any reason to believe that medical science won't eventually find a way to
prevent
this?
We definitely will. Absolutely. I mean, that kind of approach, you know, we won't find anything for smallpox. Well, we did. Mm-hmm. We won't find something for polio. Well, we did. We can't reduce the rate of heart attacks or stroke. Well, we have. We'll never, this is cancer, leukemia, Gleevec, 90% reduction in the rate of leukemic children with Gleevec. So, yes, it's just a matter of time. And I see a crescendo of ideas in terms of molecular targets. I see a crescendo of very bright and talented people entering the field. And I see this positive crescendo of very exciting papers being published addressing the biology of the disease and drugs now being tested with increasing amounts that are interesting and unique. I think it's just a question of time. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
Well, Dr. Rosenberg, we wish you nothing but success. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Roger Rosenberg is director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center and Abe Morris and William Zale Distinguished Chair in Neurology at UT Southwestern. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.